chapter 26. Coming back to Exodus tonight. After taking a break from it last week. If you remember what's been going on so far, God has been giving Moses instructions as to how he's supposed to put the tabernacle together. He called Moses up on the mountain. Remember, God has manifested himself to the children of Israel as they got to Mount Sinai, and he's manifested himself in all kinds of supernatural phenomena, sounds of a trumpet out of the heavens and smoke and fire and all this stuff. And he calls Moses to come up there again up into the mountain, and he's giving him instructions as to what he wants him to do. So last time as we looked at this in chapter 25, he went over with Moses the furniture that he wanted him to make for the tabernacle. He told him in this, and remember, tabernacle means a dwelling place. And he says there in verse 8 of chapter 25, he says, "Make them and let them make me a sanctuary or a dwelling place or a tabernacle that I may dwell among them." So the concept here is that God wants them to build a place not because God is homeless and he needs some place to hang out or something, but that he wants a place where he can come and dwell among his people, dwell among the children of Israel. So he wants them to make this building for them for that purpose. And so this is as we went over some of the furniture that was to go in there. Remember, we first dealt with the ark that he was supposed to make, the ark of the covenant that he was making, and then he talked about the table of showbread, which was a table that was set there that was going to have bread on it at all times, indicating the fellowship that would be had before God and with God. Ark of the covenant, the law was kept in it, and the mercy seat was on top of that. God would look on that and forgive the sins, atone for the sins of Israel. And then the lampstand, the golden lampstand that he talked about, he wanted that in there, and that's the only light that's being provided. Now we go from looking at the interior stuff in terms of the furniture and everything to the actual tabernacle itself. We go to the actual specifics of how this tabernacle is supposed to be built. It's interesting, though, to think about it. God started with the interior, and now he works his way outward, which is so often the way he does things anyway. He starts and works from the inside out. That's why it's a futility on our part to try to clean people up on the outside. God first deals with the inside of a man, deal first with his heart, and then the outward stuff is going to flow from that. We get things backwards sometimes when we're constantly wanting to alter people's behaviors before their hearts have been changed. But anyway, we've talked about how this tabernacle points to God's bigger plan. You know, it's one thing we sit here and we look over all this stuff, and tonight, just be prepared. There's just all these minutiae of specifics and stuff. And it's one thing to look at that and think, yeah, yawn, you know, what's this all about? But the fact is God was actually using this to typify the bigger plan, the plan that was going to have its fulfillment in Jesus Christ, when Jesus came to die for us. And so much of what we see in this tabernacle is representing to us the actual work that Jesus is going to do. And it also even represents our own lives, aspects of our own lives as the church. So let's begin here. Let's read chapter 26, let's start here in verse 1. God is still talking. He says, "Moreover, you shall make the tabernacle with 10 curtains of fine woven linen and blue, purple, and scarlet thread. With artistic designs of cherubim, you shall weave them. The length of each curtain shall be 28 cubits, and the width of each cubit, no. Those are illegal even then, I think. But the width of each curtain is 4 cubits, and every one of the curtains shall have the same measurements. 5 curtains shall be coupled to one another. Now the other 5 curtains shall be coupled to one another, and you shall make loops of blue yarn on the edge of the curtain and on the selvage of one set, and likewise you should do on the outer edge of the other curtain of the second set. 50 loops you shall make in one curtain, and 50 loops you shall make on the edge of the curtain, that is on the end of the second set, that the loops may be clasped to one another. And you shall make 50 clasps of gold, and couple the curtains together with the clasps, so that they may be one tabernacle." Now see, if I were Moses, I would say, "No, wait a minute, you wanted what?" Because that was kind of complicated and kind of convoluted. So we're going to walk through this a little bit. You know, it gets, you know, you read through something like that, and boy, I don't know, if you're like me, you read through something like that and you can't even remember a thing you just read. It's almost meaningless. But as we get into it, as we look at this, there's some interesting stuff in this. There's actually four sets of curtain, and they're like layers of curtains that this ark is going to be built out of. You want to go ahead and put that up there for me, Robbie, and then you can have a seat. I'm just going to leave that up there. I wanted to give you kind of a visual reference. These are artistic interpretations of what it is that is being described here, but this can kind of help a little bit. What the tabernacle is made out of, in essence, is layers of curtains, and it does have an interior frame, and we'll get to that. But he begins here. We're talking here first on the fine woven interior layer, the interior curtain that's supposed to be hanging on the inside of the whole tabernacle, it's oftentimes referred to, or even in theological terms, as being the heavenly covering, and because it's got the representation of angelic beings surrounding it at all times. So it's designed to be on the interior only. You only see it from the interior. It was made by sewing together, putting together, rather, all of these curtains. Each one is 42 feet long and 6 feet wide, and the 10 curtains then ultimately make up a full covering that's 42 feet by 60 feet. It's interesting because what he tells us here is that they're not to be sewn together. When you think of getting these materials together, you think in your mind, okay, well, we got to sew these all up together and make a nice little pup tent out of this or whatever. But God doesn't want him to do that. He wants them to remain individual sets here, individual pieces, these curtains that are woven together. And he tells them to connect them with these blue threads and with clasps, golden clasps that are put together. So that's how it's joined together. So that, you know, it says so that the tabernacle may be one piece, is all joined together, is one thing, he says there in verse 6, that it may be one tabernacle. And right off the bat, see, we see God is pointing towards the idea of unity and diversity. He didn't want these pieces of cloth sewn up together, but he wanted them to be distinct and separate from one another, yet all creating a unified whole. And that really does end up then representing the work that Christ has done in us as the church, because that's exactly what we have within the church. We have separate and individual identities and personalities that are brought together and joined together to form a unified whole of a community that represents the kingdom of heaven. Paul talks about in Romans 12:5, he says, We being many are one body in Christ, and individually members of one another. So the whole concept was there, and God's speaking that, you know, even through the simple design, well, not simple, through this fairly complex design of the tabernacle. He's getting a message across, the idea of unity, a singular building, a singular workmanship that's made out of all of these diverse parts. And so that's kind of cool. Anyway, we keep going here. Pick up in verse 7. You shall also make curtains of goat's hair to be a tent over the tabernacle. You shall make 11 curtains. The length of each curtain shall be 30 cubits, and the width of each curtain 4 cubits, and the 11 curtains shall have the same measurements. And you shall couple 5 curtains by themselves and 6 curtains by themselves, and you shall double over the 6th curtain at the forefront of the tent. You shall make 50 loops on the edge of the curtain, that the outermost in one set, and 50 loops on the edge of the curtain that's in the second set. And you shall make 50 bronze clasps. Put the clasps into the loops, tab A into slot B, and couple the tent together that it may be one. I've had instructions for knockdown furniture that's similar to this kind of thing. The remnant that remains of the curtains of the tent, the half curtain that remains, shall hang over the back of the tabernacle, and a cubit on one side and a cubit on the other side of what remains of the length of the curtains of the tent shall hang over the sides of the tabernacle on this side and on that side to cover it. Okay, what this is exciting stuff to read, no doubt about it. This is riveting. What this is then, what he's describing here, after the fine linen covering that's on the interior thing, then he describes another one, another layer that goes on top of that, which is made out of goat's hair covering, which has a felt-like quality. It's a darker thing, and it's made out of 11 strips of fabric that are 45 feet long and 6 feet wide, and they're also joined by a series of loops and clasps. That's the same principle that we see there going on in that. The goat hair covering, the measurements on that take it out longer than the interior one. And that's what he talks about. Make sure that part of it is hanging over the back and part of it's hanging down over the sides of it on either side. And so it is completely this darker covering completely blots out and covers up the sides and the front and the back of the linen covering, the finer one that has the angelic representation on side. So basically, what we have here is the idea here is that this outer covering, this darker covering, completely covers and obscures the heavenly covering that's inside. It's the darker goatskin completely covers over the interior one. It wouldn't be transparent. It wouldn't be open. You wouldn't catch a glimpse of it from the outside at all. All you would see is this darker felt, this darker goat hair covering right there. And it's revealing something to us here. God, just even by this command here, is revealing something to the Israelites and reveals it to us as well, that these heavenly things, this heavenly covering, that place that's representative of that throne room, you know, surrounded by the cherubim in its finery and its beauty, is covered over by a darkness, and there's no seeing it from the outside. The only way that you ever see this is by going in to the inside of it. The only time that you're aware of or able to see these heavenly things is by entering into the tabernacle, going in through the door of the tabernacle. And there's a singular doorway, and we'll get to that. But, you know, this is true like what Paul says. The natural mind doesn't grasp the things of the Spirit. That's why we said before, you know, experts end up being people that have a difficult time being able to see the truth, being able to hear the truth, because they know too much and it's too difficult for them to be able to grasp these things. They're not seen from the outside. A person has to go to the inside. And of course, Jesus in John 10 describes himself as the door, as the singular door through which any man's going to come to the Father. So that's why, you know, even look, we look around at some of the stuff going on in our culture right now, the huge cultural war that broke out over a movie. God went to the movies, and now there's a big outbreak of controversy over the whole thing. And, you know, you hear so many people's responses and observations of this thing, ranging from, you know, legitimate critiques of movie making to the absolute, you know, ludicrous of charges of all kinds of stuff that's coming through in this movie. But it all comes down to this, that, you know, it's an insider-outsider kind of thing. As difficult as that is to actually say, it's really true. An insider, someone who's gone through that door, someone who is able to grasp heavenly things because of that relationship with Jesus, is able to look at some of the things that are portrayed in that movie, and it hits home in powerful ways. It's intense. But for someone who's outside of that, all they see is a felt goat skin. All they see is something that is, you know, dark and violent and graphic, and it's terrible, and why would I want to subject myself to it? One guy said, I'd rather just go ahead and bludgeon myself for 2 hours and 6 minutes rather than go see this movie. So, you know, it's one of these things, and it's portrayed right here even in the building of the tabernacle, that those heavenly things are obscured from sight from the outside. A person has to go inside. A person has to be on the inside of that to be able to see it. And he has to go through that singular doorway of Jesus. Well, verse 14, he says, you shall also make a covering of ram skins dyed red for the tent, and a covering of badger skins above that. So two more layers he just quickly adds in there for good measure. The ram skin would have been like very fine leather, and he wanted that dyed red. And there are obvious implications in terms of that red covering, speaking of the blood and the atonement that comes through the blood. But the ram skin would be there, and it's a leather, would be a leather skin going across that. So again, we've got another darkening agent. And then this other one, there's some dispute about the badger skin concept. There's a lot of people that are saying it's not talking about badger skin at all. It's talking about porpoise skin or sea cow skin. Both of which, you wouldn't think there would be a lot of sources for that out in the desert. But all agree that the basic idea is that it is a very durable hide of some kind, a very durable skin. Maybe what they're trying to say is akin to, or whatever. Maybe they do. You know, who knows? In Egypt, maybe they had just a huge, big, you know, porpoise skin warehouse, and they were able to go in there and buy all they needed before they left. But either way, it's very durable, and the idea is it's durable, and it's waterproof, and it's weatherproof. And even though it's really bland-looking on the outside then, and, you know, kind of gnarly-looking from the outside, it's going to be something that's going to be able to go through all of the weather changes and the desert climates and stuff. But it also is going to end up making it a very dark place. And you realize that that's a big darkening agent there. All of these coverings over top of this thing. Now, this artist over here, it's actually taken from a photograph of a model that somebody made, has the sides of this coming out at an angle. But I've seen other models where they, since it's not implied that it's doing that directly from the text. I've seen a lot of models where it just hangs straight down. It makes sense to me that it would be at an angle, because then you got a good runoff, and also it would be more aerodynamic, so that if winds were coming through the desert or whatever like that, you wouldn't have as much pressure against it. But either way, it's kind of, you know, it's not real impressive. It's just there. But all of these things are representative. You know, here's this bland, this common, this ordinary, this very tough and weathered outer covering of this thing that houses the mysteries of heaven. And of course, we don't even have to think that hard to realize how that's representative of Jesus, how he came, you know, just as a common man. He was completely human. We never want to forget that fact. And sometimes we lose sight of that. That's one of the things that struck home. Riley even mentioned that. Strikes home in that Passion movie. The humanity of Christ. You know, this is something that he had to do. The doctrine of kenosis. He emptied himself of all of his divine attributes and his glory, and he came down to earth and dwelt among us as a human being, as a man. He suspended those divine attributes of omniscience and omnipresence and all of those things, and he even suspended his independent operation of them, so that he had to trust in the Father to show him and to reveal to him. And so here he is as a man, as a common man, and the prophets even say there was nothing so handsome about him that would make us attracted to him or anything, just your average Joe living here, and yet housed inside of him the wonders and the mysteries of heaven, the actual avenue and gateway into the very presence of God. That's who Jesus is. That simple desert tent is kind of God's blueprint, pointing the way, laying the groundwork for the thing that he was going to do there. And see, and in the interior then, it's all dark except for that singular lamp, that one golden lamp that illuminates and provides the only light that's there. Picking up in verse 15. And for the tabernacle, you shall make the boards of acacia wood standing upright. 10 cubits shall be the length of the board, and a cubit and a half shall be the width of each board. 2 tenons, or tabs, shall be in each board for binding one to another. Thus you shall make for all the boards of the tabernacle, and you shall make the boards of the tabernacle, 20 boards for the south side, and 40 sockets of silver under the 20 boards, 2 sockets under each of the boards for its 2 tenons, or tabs. And for the second side of the tabernacle, the north side, there shall be 20 boards, and this is all very similar to the other side, and it's the same thing. And you shall, verse 23, and you shall also make 2 boards for the back corners of the tabernacle. They shall be coupled together at the bottom, and they shall be coupled together at the top by one ring. Thus it shall be for both of them, they shall be for the 2 corners. There shall be 8 boards with their sockets of silver, 16 sockets, 2 sockets under each of the boards. So, you got that? That really didn't even need explaining. You figure that all out. Actually, what we have here, this is the skeletal structure inside of all of these coverings. First, God described to Moses the fabric coverings that were going to be going around this, but now he's describing the framework of it, the interior skeleton of it. And it's made out of 50 boards, and you can kind of see that down over here. On the picture to the far left, those are the boards going up and right, up and down like that, planks basically, and they're overlaid with gold, acacia wood overlaid with gold. And we kind of talked about the significance of that last time. That's representative of the Messiah. The boards are joined by a series of these tabs, which are basically rings that the adjoining boards go through, and that provides the support structure. And the boards are supposed to have, down at the bottom, as you can see, do you think it'll feed back if I walk over here? Down at the bottom, it talks about these sockets, the silver sockets down in here. The idea behind that is these little footies, basically, at the bottom of the board that go down there, and they're made out of silver, and so that ends up, you know, being then the foundation basically of this tabernacle. You've got all this gold, but then down at the bottom you've got a foundation of silver, and that's interesting because silver, we talked about that earlier on. Silver ends up being the precious metal that is representative of redemption. You know, in Exodus 21:32, a person, if he can't restore something, he can pay a certain amount of silver in order to provide ransom or redemption for something done. Leviticus 5:15, Leviticus 27:3, and 27:6 say the same thing, as well as other places. Talks about that, and the idea of silver being associated with the work of redemption. we also know, I mean, we can think towards the New Testament and we remember that it was 30 pieces of silver that Judas betrays Jesus for, representative of what it, you know, what price was paid to get him to that cross, that simple little act of betrayal that provided him that paltry sum, really. So the foundation then of the tabernacle being underneath all of these boards was pointing towards the redemptive work of Christ, that this whole dwelling, this whole tabernacle, the place where God was going to come and he was going to dwell with man and meet with man and have this communion with him and this interaction with him, was there with the foundation of redemption, which is beautiful, really, because you think about what it means. I mean, what the fall did, what the fall produced in this world. In order for man to be able to dwell with God once again, there has to be a foundation laid of redemption. Something had to take place in order to bring us back into fellowship with him. And so it's all laid on that kind of a foundation, that whole concept there. And it also then speaks to the work of God in us. As we think about that, not only, you know, is the concept of unity through diversity, but also then we see how his work of redemption is laid for a foundation for every one of us. Every one of us who have relationship with God have to have that relationship through the redemption that's purchased by the blood of Jesus Christ, what he did for us. That's the very thing that lays the foundation on which any relationship with God is built. And what that does is unique and significant in itself. He put these footies underneath there. You know, he put these sockets underneath it to keep the sides of this tabernacle, to keep this structure separate just that much from the world. You think about it. It's in the world. It's on the planet. It's right there on the desert. And yet it's distinct from that desert floor by this silver redemption. It's distinct from that. That's exactly the work that God does in our lives. He rescues us. He provides this salvation for us. But we're still right here in this awful, ugly world. And yet, there's something different about us. There's a distinction between us and the rest of this world. It's that work of redemption. He redeemed us. He provided something new. We're in this world, but we're not of this world. We're planted here, and yet we're not corrupted by it because of what Jesus did in redemption, because of that silver redemption, the silver sockets, the foundation that's provided. All right, we pick up here in verse 26. You shall make bars of acacia wood, 5 for the boards on one side of the tabernacle, 5 bars for the boards on the other side of the tabernacle, 5 bars for the boards on the side of the tabernacle in the far west. Yeah, da, 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 da. Verse 28, the middle bar shall pass through the midst of the boards from end to end. You shall overlay the boards with gold, make the rings gold as holders for the bars, and overlay the bars with gold, and you shall raise up the tabernacle according to its pattern which you were shown in the mountain. So here are bars that run the length of the tabernacle. In other words, you've got all of these upright supports going up this way, and then you've got these bars, and there's 4 of them that go up through there, and then there's a 5th one that runs, and it says through the midst of them. So it's actually hidden. It runs in through the midst of the other layers there. And that's the support structure that ties all of these bars together, ties all of the planks together and holds it then as a rigid structure. The concept is it's made to be portable. You realize that, I'm sure. You're picking that up as we go over this. You know, later on they build a temple and it's different. And it's different from this, but it's based on the same kind of plan, but it's different and distinct in the way it's made, etc. But this right here was designed to be portable. They could pick it up, you know, as they're marching through on their way to the promised land. And so this was one of the ways in which it was going to be put together here. Why one of those things would have been hidden? One of the bars that goes across. You've got 4 that are obvious, and 1 that says in verse 28 that runs through the midst of it, the boards from end to end. And there's some interesting theories on that. None of them really impressed me, except one that I was looking at that was talking about the fact that when we think about the structure that we have, when we think about any kind of relationship with God that we have, there are certain visible aspects to it that we see. Certain aspects of God's work and his redemption and the stuff that we have, we can even think in terms of it on a theological level. We build a certain structure of theology concerning our relationship with God. There are truths that we build upon, and Paul talks about the foundation laid by the prophets and the apostles and all of that. But yet, there's one aspect there that's always going to remain mysterious. There's, for as much that we have that is visible that we can see, as much structure as we see that we can look at as being a tangible thing, there's also this thread of mystery that runs through the whole thing that we never want to lose sight of. God is so mysterious. For all of the things that we may be able to find out and may be able to understand to whatever degree we can, there's going to be a lot more mystery to it as well. And that's something important to actually keep in mind, even as we develop this relationship with God. The mystery is still very important. A.W. Tozer wrote a tremendous article I was just reading the other day out of Root of the Righteous. And it says, make room for mystery. And the whole concept is when we start developing our relationship with God into a formula, when we define truth as a formulaic concept of these doctrines piled on top of these doctrines, we lose sight of what it means to know the truth. It's one thing to know the truth, but it's another thing to know the truth, to be in relationship and learning and knowing the truth. And if we eliminate mystery out of our relationship with God, if we eliminate mystery out of God, if we sit around and think, oh yeah, I got this all figured out, I know all the attributes of God, I understand my theology, I got all my ducks in a row that way, and we eliminate that mystery, we're going to find ourselves, well, we're probably going to find ourselves kind of shocked at times in life, because God has a way of busting out of any box that we make for him. But it's just one of those things. That could be a reason why he wanted this one hidden rod going through the rest of the structure. Picking up in verse 31, it says, you shall make a veil woven of blue, purple, and scarlet thread and fine woven linen. It shall be woven with an artistic design of cherubim. You shall hang it upon the four pillars of acacia wood overlaid with gold. Their hooks shall be gold upon four sockets of silver. You shall hang the veil from the clasps, and you shall bring the Ark of the Testimony in there behind the veil, and the veil shall be a divider for you between the holy place and the most holy. Keep reading here, verse 34, and you shall put the mercy seat upon the Ark of the Testimony in the most holy. You shall set the table outside the veil and the lampstand across from the table on the side of the tabernacle towards the south, and you shall put the table on the north side. God commands that a veil be made, and that's interior stuff, and I don't have a picture of that, but picture it in your mind. It's a big box. The whole room is one big, huge, interior, rectangular tent. And God is commanding him to make one more veil, and he wants that put up with clasps and rings as a divider in there, so that the back portion, the farther back portion of the tabernacle, is going to be sealed off with this veil that he commands him to make. And so this is the traditionally referred to as the holy, well, it's what he calls the holy of holies. This is the holy place, the holy of holies. The whole place, the whole tabernacle, let me get this straight so you don't get confused. The whole tabernacle on the interior part of it is called the holy place. This little section that he's telling him to cordon off here is called the holy of holies, holy of holies. And this was basically a dividing place. That's what he commands for him. He tells him to make it out of expensive fabrics. And all of the colors that he tells him to use are relating to Christ. The blue is representative of his heavenly origin. The purple is representative of his royalty. He is the king that we were expecting. And the scarlet, of course, is representative of the redemptive work that he does through the shedding of his blood. And so all of these things relate to Christ and is supposed to be inlaid with designs, again, of cherubim. And I sure wish they would have described that part, but they don't. And so we don't have any idea of what that is or what it is he's describing there. In our minds, we think of Renaissance angels, little kids with wings and, you know, puffy-faced kids and creepy. But either way, but we don't know. We have no idea what this is. This is, he tells them to put cherubim on all of the things. And this is supposed to be this divider. And it's where they're going to put the ark. So the ark then goes inside of this one little area, and the mercy seat is on that. And no one is going to access this. And we'll find out more about that as we go along. But no one accesses this. No one goes in there. No one goes in and chit-chats with God at the mercy seat or anything like that. The high priest is the only one allowed behind that veil, and that is once a year on the Day of Atonement. And so this is a very, you know, a serious divide that God takes it seriously as he's putting it together. Remember, one of the things that we talked about is one of the reasons for the law, one of the reasons that God provided this was not only to show his righteousness, not only to show the depth of depravity that man had fallen into, but also to keep man, to keep this fallen man at a safe distance from God. And so that's the concept here too. This is something to keep man at a safe distance away from a righteous God. It's not safe to be in there. In fact, on the Day of Atonement, when the high priest would go in there, the high priest would be adorned with bells on his tassels, and he would also have a rope tied around his ankle, so that if while he was in there, it turned out that he was actually not so good, and he dropped over dead, they could yank him out of there and stuff. So I mean, this was not this was not a job that you took lightly. In other words, this was a serious deal. And so this concept here, the presence of the Lord, the Shekinah glory, the manifest presence of His glory and His weight, was going to be there, dwelling above the mercy seat there in some unique, specific location that he was going to do, that he was going to provide. And it was, it was a serious thing. But that's what's so significant then, as we go to the New Testament and we look at that and we realize, what took place there. In the account of the Gospels, when Jesus died on the cross, when he died, it says that the veil in the temple later on, this whole thing gets transferred over to the permanent location of the temple. And that veil is still there, though at the time of Jesus, the ark was not there. But that veil was still there. The Holy of Holies was still. As a matter of fact, it's very interesting that I was reading this little account. This is totally off the subject. The Greek general, or was it the Roman general? Roman or Greek general Pompey? Roman general Pompey, yeah, thank you. Walked in into Jerusalem and walked into the temple and decided he wanted to find out what the mysterious stuff was behind this veil was. And he walked back there and was utterly shocked to find nothing back there. He thought for sure there'd at least be, a statue of a god or something like that, but they found just an empty room. But so this continued on, and this is why it's so significant that when Jesus died on the cross and he said, "It's finished," that the veil in the temple was torn, and the gospel account says it was torn from top to bottom. God was showing there that he was removing the old in order to bring in the new. And that's what Hebrews 10 then tells us as well. Hebrews 10:19 says, "Now we have boldness. We can go into this holy place. Whereas once we had to remain at a safe distance from God. God had to keep us, back, like a little kid's gate there." Not kid's gate, that's our church thing. But there's a little thing. You know what I'm talking about? You have to put them there so the kids don't fall down the stairs and stuff like that. The same thing. Just so the kids didn't stumble into God's presence and, go up in flames or whatever. God had to keep us at a safe distance. And God then, through the work that Jesus did, was able to remove that so that now it's not a matter of us being consumed. We can go directly into His presence. It doesn't take any kind of special Day of Atonement. It doesn't take anything. At any moment, when I'm driving down the road and I'm listening to music or whatever, I can enter into that Holy of Holy place. I can enter in there and fellowship with God. In fact, Hebrews, that's what it even says, is that we enter in by the veil that is His flesh. So the concept is, it's because He offered His flesh like that, because He sacrificed Himself like that on the cross on our behalf, He took away these ordinances. So now we have this access into Him. God doesn't have to keep us away, keep Himself at a safe distance from us, but he welcomes us in. He opens up His arm and scoops us up and brings us close to Himself, which is His plan all along. And the fact that this mercy seat is hidden behind this veil, and God tore that in two at the time that Jesus died, showing His fulfillment of what that mercy seat was pointing to, the redemption, the atonement provided by His blood. It's a beautiful picture to me. I love that. I love that aspect. We pick up here in verse... wait a minute. Before I do that, before I go down, then he talked about setting up the furniture, how he wanted this set up. First, he's got the Holy of Holies, and then he says here in verse 34, put the mercy seat inside that little area. So you've got the ark back inside that part there. And then he wants the table of showbread to be out on the north side of the tabernacle. So that would be on the right. As you'd enter into the tabernacle, the table of showbread would be on the right. And then he wanted the lampstand, the golden lampstand, opposite of that on the other side. So it would be over here to your left. And of course, it's not mentioned in this particular passage, but the table of incense is set up there on the other side, pointing to that. And so all of these things, these pieces of furniture that we described them last week, but all of these things that go into the tabernacle, again, are representative of Jesus' work. Everything here. I mean, we can go through, and like I said, A.B. Simpson's got a great book on it, and there's others. Lockyer's got a great book on all the messianic prophecies, and just love reading through that stuff and rekindling the remembrance of what this is all about. You know, this is representative of Jesus Christ, what we see there. When you walk into that ark, that tabernacle, and that mercy seat, the ark is there behind the veil. It's representative of Christ. That mercy is there and present. The mercy that's provided for us through his death on the cross. And then the table of showbread, which is representative of the fellowship. And that's what Christ provides for us as well. The fellowship with God that we didn't have once before. And it's a fellowship with one another as well. It draws us into a community that we never would have known outside of him. You know, if it weren't for Jesus, I wouldn't know you guys. I wouldn't even think about you. I wouldn't be anywhere. I'd be, you know, hanging around watching cartoons all day or something. But because of the work of Christ, we are drawn into this fellowship with him at the center of it, this showbread, the bread of life that's provided for us. And then the lampstand, the golden lampstand, which is the illumination. If it weren't for Christ and his work that he did, we'd be wandering around in darkness. We wouldn't see. We wouldn't be able to see clearly at all. Not that we'd necessarily see clearly, but we wouldn't be able to see. We wouldn't know the way. But because Jesus came, because he lived on this earth, because he died for us, the way he died for us, he provides then illumination for us. We know who we are. We know who we belong to. We know where we're going. Unlike the way we were before we knew Jesus, when it was all just this bumbling set of experiences that were, by and large, pretty miserable, a sense of a meaningless existence. Now we have meaning. Now we have purpose. It's illuminated for us because we know Jesus and because of what he's done for us. That's what's typified in all of these things in the ark. I mean, it's, you know, it's a, you're reading an architectural plan. Yeah, yawn, big deal. But yet when you think about what it's representing, when you think about the fact that God had this plan in place, this was something that, and he's speaking mysteries through a building plan. I think that's fascinating. God uses whatever he wants to. I mean, you know, we keep referencing this movie, but here's God showing up in an R-rated movie, just running wild through the earth, and it's magnificent. And God shows up here in this blueprint and reveals what his plan is, how he's going to redeem mankind, what his plan is for mankind. I'm going to give them mercy. They've fallen so far from me, but I'm scooping them up and bringing them to myself. I'm going to have fellowship with them. I'm going to bring them back to what they were designed for. We were designed to be in fellowship with God. We were designed for this kind of community. We're going to have this kind of community all through eternity. I mean, we're getting in good practice now, but we're getting good practice for it. And then this illumination that he's provided for us. I don't know. I get excited. I'm sorry. I'll shut up. Let's get down to verse 36. He said, "You shall make a screen for the door of the tabernacle, woven of blue, purple, and scarlet thread, and fine woven linen made by a weaver. And you shall make for the screen five pillars of acacia wood and overlay them with gold. Their hooks shall be gold, and you shall cast five sockets of bronze for them." So basically, that's just the front of the tabernacle. All the other things that we've been describing have gone around the sides and the back. And this right here, then, is the very front. That's a singular doorway then. This screen is a singular passageway into this temple, into this tabernacle. And again, this is it's made out of the same kind of stuff, and it's the same color scheme. And here, though, the difference is at the base of these things, instead of the silver foundation, it's bronze. It's a bronze socket that he tells him to put these beams down into. Bronze is a metal that has to be refined by fire, and it's always used as a symbol of endurance through trial. You remember in Revelation when Jesus reveals himself to John, or you can go read it at some point, when Jesus appears to John on the island of Patmos, one of the things that he notices about him is that his flesh is glowing like bronze. And it's symbolic of his overcoming of the trial that he went through, the suffering that he endured and came through shining like bronze. And so there again, we get a picture of Christ, even with this bronze, a singular entrance. There's only one way that anyone's coming into the presence of the Father, only one way that somebody comes into this heavenly place to know these things. And it's through Jesus Christ. He's the one who made that claim. I don't have to try to defend what I'm saying there. He's the one who said it, not me. And I believe it, and I'm glad for it. I'm rejoicing because of it. But he also put these bronze, that's interesting, these bronze fittings at the base of it, because the entryway into that tabernacle had to come through such severe trial that Jesus had to endure. And we know that the same then actually gets applied to us. Because as much as we would love to imagine that the trip to heaven is just a ride on a glory train, a happy little marshmallow ride on a whatever. I don't even know what I was going to go, what I was going to say there, but you get my point. As much as we'd like to think of it as being easy street, it's not. And we know that not only is the biblical record stating this, but our own experience states this, that there are things that we endure. There are trials that we go through. There are heartbreaks that we face. There are sufferings that we have to endure. But that's why Jesus said that he who endures to the end is going to be saved. The concept is not that we add anything to the sacrifice of Christ. He's the one who did it. But yet we also know that the pathway, as we journey towards our home, as we journey back into God's presence, there are things that we're going to face. There are difficult times. There are difficult avenues that we have to go down. But Jesus went down them first. And he said that he saw to it, you know, that he didn't say it. It was C.S. Lewis's book, but the concept is he saw to it that the worst of it fell on himself. He's the one who paved the way. He's the one who's the firstborn from the dead. He's the one who suffered it the greatest. And now we come into this fellowship with God. We come into this heavenly dwelling in the end through his endurance of a fiery trial, of the brutality that he endured on the cross. He did that for us so that we could enter in. And now we, looking to his sacrifice for us, are able to endure and able to overcome and overcome the things that we face in this life. So anyway, that's how Christ is revealed there, even in the structure of the tabernacle, which I guess you got to be of a certain disposition to get excited about, but I got excited about it. So anyway, I hope it was at least somewhat informative for you. So Father, we just thank you for your word. We thank you that you reveal so much through it. I could pick up 100 books on architecture and blueprints and never find any real meaning from it. But I can pick up your word and I can look at this, just this, what would seem like a mundane explanation of the way you want a building made, and I see a cosmic plan. I see something profound, and I even see my own name written in it because I get to come home to you through all of the things that you've provided for redemption, for justification, for atonement. And I thank you for that, Father. And so I just pray that your word will have its place in our hearts and that we'll grow by it and learn from it. And I pray this, Lord, in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen.